There are certainly such things as ghost photographs, Chafee said in a rich, pedantic voice that made Pop want to strangle him. But these are not ghost photographs. They're sure as hell not normal photographs. My point exactly, Chafee said, frowning slightly. But what sort of photographs are they? One can hardly say, can one? One can only display a perfectly normal camera that photographs a dog which is apparently preparing to leap, and once it leaps, it will be gone from the frame of the picture. At that point, one of three things may happen. The camera may start taking normal pictures, which is to say, pictures of the things it is aimed at. It may take no more pictures at all. Its one purpose to photograph, to document, one might even say, that dog completed. Or it may simply go on taking pictures of that white fence and the ill-tended lawn behind it. He paused and added, I suppose someone might walk by at some point, 40 photographs down the line, or 400, but unless the photographer's raised his angle, which he doesn't seem to have done in any of these, one would only see the passerby from the waist down, more or less. And echoing Kevin's father without even knowing who Kevin's father was, he added, Pardon me for saying so, Mr. Merrill, but you've shown me something I thought I'd never see, an inexplicable and almost irrefutable paranormal occurrence that is really quite boring. This amazing but apparently sincere remark forced Pop to disregard whatever Chafee might think about his sanity and ask again,
It really is only a dog, as far as you can see?
Of course, Chafee said, looking mildly surprised. A stray mongrel that looks exceedingly bad-tempered. He sighed. And it wouldn't be taken seriously, of course. What I mean is, it wouldn't be taken seriously by people who don't know you personally, Mr. Merrill, people who aren't familiar with your honesty and reliability in these matters. It looks like a trick, you see, and not even a very good one. Something on the order of a child's magic eight ball. 2 weeks ago, Pop would have argued strenuously against such an idea. But that was before he had been not walked, but actually propelled from that bastard McCarty's house.
Well, if that's your final word, Pop said, getting up and taking the camera by the strap.
I'm very sorry you made the trip to such little purpose, Chafee said, and then his horrid grin burst forth again, all rubbery lips and huge teeth shining with spit. I was about to make myself a spam sandwich when you drove in. Would you care to join me, Mr. Merrill? I make quite a nice one, if I do say so myself. I add a little horseradish and Bermuda onion. That's my secret. And then
I'll pass, Pop said heavily.
As in the Puss Sisters' parlor, all he really wanted right now was to get out of there and put miles between himself and this grinning idiot. Pop had a definite allergy to places where he had gambled and lost. Just lately, there seemed to be a lot of those. Too goddamn many.
I already had my dinner, is what I mean to say. Got to be getting back.
Chafee laughed fruitily. The lot of the toiler in the vineyards is busy, but yields great bounty, he said.
Not just lately, Pop thought. Just lately it ain't yielding no fucking bounty at all. It's a living, anyway, Pop replied,
and was eventually allowed out of the house, which was damp and chill. What it must be like to live in such a place come February, Pop couldn't imagine, and had that mousy, mildewed smell that might be rotting curtains and sofa covers and such, or just the smell money leaves behind when it has spent a longish period of time in a place and then departed. He thought the fresh October air, tinged with just a small taste of the lake and a stronger tang of pine needles, had never smelled so good. He got into his car and started it up. Emery Chafee, unlike the Puss Sister, who had shown him as far as the door and then closed it quickly behind him, as if afraid the sun might strike her and turn her to dust like a vampire, was standing on the front porch, grinning his idiot grin, and actually waving, as if he were seeing Pop off on a goddamn ocean cruise. And, without thinking, just as he had taken the picture of, or at anyway, the old black woman without thinking, he had snapped Chafee, and the just-starting-to-molder house, which was all that remained of the Chafee family holdings. He didn't remember picking the camera up off the seat, where he had tossed it in disgust before closing his door, was not even aware that the camera was in his hands, or the shutter fired, until he heard the whine of the mechanism, shoving the photograph out like a tongue coated with some bland gray fluid. milk of magnesia, perhaps. That sound seemed to vibrate along his nerve endings now, making them scream. It was like the feeling you got when something too cold or hot hit a new filling. He was peripherally aware that Chafee was laughing as if it was the best goddamn joke in the world before snatching the picture from the slot in a kind of furious horror, telling himself he had imagined the momentary, blurred sound of a snarl, a sound like you might hear if a powerboat was approaching while you had your head ducked underwater, telling himself he had imagined the momentary feeling that the camera had bulged in his hands, as if some huge pressure inside had pushed the sides out momentarily. He punched at the glove compartment button and threw the picture inside, and then closed it so hard and fast that he tore his thumbnail all the way down to the tender quick. He pulled out jerkily, almost stalling, then almost hitting one of the hoary old spruces which flanked the house end of the long Chafee driveway. And all the way up that driveway, he thought he could hear Emery Chafee laughing in loud, mindless, cheery bellows of sound. Ha, 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 ha. His heart slammed in his chest, and his head felt as if someone was using a sledgehammer inside there. The small cluster of veins, which nestled in the hollows of each temple, pulsed steadily. He got himself under control little by little. 5 miles, and the little man inside his head quit using the sledgehammer. 10 miles. By now, he was almost halfway back to Castle Rock, and his heartbeat was back to normal. And he told himself,
"You ain't gonna look at it. You ain't. Let the goddamn thing rot in there. You don't need to look at it, and you don't need to take no more of them either. Time to mark the thing off as a dead loss. Time to do what you should have let the boy do in the first place."
So, of course, when he got to the Castle View rest area, a turnout from which you could, it seemed, see all of western Maine and half of New Hampshire, he swung in and turned off his motor and opened the glove compartment and brought out the picture which he had taken with no more intent or knowledge than a man might have if he did a thing while walking in his sleep. The photograph had developed in there, of course. The chemicals inside that deceptively flat square had come to life and done their usual efficient job. Dark or light, it didn't make any difference to a Polaroid picture. The dog thing was crouched all the way down now. It was as fully coiled as it was going to get, a trigger pulled back to full cock. Its teeth had outgrown its mouth, so that the thing's snarl seemed now to be not only an expression of rage, but a simple necessity. How could its lips ever fully close over those teeth? How could those jaws ever chew? It looked more like a weird species of wild boar than a dog now. But what it really looked like was nothing Pop had ever seen before. It did more than hurt his eyes to look at it. It hurt his mind. It made him feel as if he was going crazy.
"Why not get rid of that camera right here?" he thought suddenly. "You can. Just get out, walk to the guardrail there, and toss her over. All gone. Goodbye."
But that would have been an impulsive act, and Pop Merrill belonged to the reasonable tribe. Belonged to it body and soul, is what I mean to say. He didn't want to do anything on the spur of the moment that he might regret later. And,
"If you don't do this, you'll regret it later."
But no. And no, and no. A man couldn't run against his nature. It was unnatural. He needed time to think, to be sure. He compromised by throwing the print out instead, and then drove on quickly. For a minute or two, he felt as if he might throw up, but the urge passed. When he did, he felt a little more himself. Safely back in his shop, he unlocked the steel box, took out the sun, rummaged through his keys once more, and located the one for the drawer where he kept his special items. He started to put the camera inside, and paused, brow furrowed. The image of the chopping block out back entered his mind with such clarity, every detail crisply lined, that it was like a photograph itself. He thought,
"Never mind all that about how a man can't run against his nature. That's crap, and you know it. It ain't in a man's nature to eat dirt. But you could eat a whole bowl of it by the bald-headed Christ if someone with a gun pointed at your head told you to do it. You know what time it is, chummy. Time to do what you should have let the boy do in the first place. After all, it ain't like you got any investment in this."
But at this, another part of his mind rose in angry, fist-waving protest.
Yes, I do. I do have an investment, goddammit. That kid smashed a perfectly good Polaroid camera. He may not know it, but that don't change the fact that I'm out $139. Oh, shit on toast, he muttered agitatedly. It ain't that. It ain't the fucking money.
No, it wasn't the fucking money. He could at least admit that it wasn't the money. He could afford it. Pa could indeed have afforded a great deal, including his own mansion in Portland's Bramhall district and a brand new Mercedes-Benz to go in the carport. He never would have bought those things. He pinched his pennies and chose to regard almost pathological miserliness as nothing more than good old Yankee thrift. But that didn't mean he couldn't have had them if he so chose. It wasn't about money. It was about something more important than money ever could be. It was about not getting skinned. Pop had made a life's work out of not getting skinned, and on the few occasions when he had been, he felt like a man with red ants crawling around inside his skull. Take the business of the goddamn Kraut record player, for instance. When Pop found out that antique dealer from Boston, Donahue his name had been, had gotten $50 more than he'd ought to have gotten for a 1915 Victor Graff gramophone, which had actually turned out to be a much more common 1919 model, Pop had lost $300 worth of sleep over it, sometimes plotting various forms of revenge, each more wild-eyed and ridiculous than the last, sometimes just damning himself for a fool, telling himself he must really be slipping if a city man like that Donahue could skin Pop Merrill. And sometimes he imagined the fucker telling his poker buddies about how easy it had been. Hell, they were all just a bunch of rubes up there. He believed that if you tried to sell the Brooklyn Bridge to a fellow like that country mouse Merrill in Castle Rock, the damned fool would ask, "How much?" Then him and his cronies rocking back in their chairs around that poker table. Why he always saw them around such a table in this morbid daydream, Pop didn't know, but he did. Smoking dollar cigars and roaring with laughter like a bunch of trolls. The business of the Polaroid was eating into him like acid, but he still wasn't ready to let go of the thing yet. Not quite yet. "You're crazy," a voice shouted at him. "You're crazy to go on with it." "Damned if I'll eat it," he muttered sulkily to that voice and to his empty, shadowed store, which ticked softly to itself like a bomb in a suitcase. "Damned if I will." But that didn't mean that he had to go herring off on any more stupid goddamn trips trying to sell the son of a whore. And he certainly didn't mean to take any more pictures with it. He judged there were at least three more safe ones left in it, and there were probably as many as seven. But he wasn't going to be the one to find out. Not at all. Still, something might come up. You never knew. And it could hardly do him or anyone else any harm locked up in a drawer, could it? Nope. Pop agreed briskly to himself. He dropped the camera inside, locked the drawer, repocketed his keys, and then went to the door and turned closed over to open with the air of a man who has finally put some nagging problem behind him for good. Pop woke up at 3 the next morning, bathed with sweat, and peering fearfully into the dark. The clocks had just begun another weary run at the hour. It was not this sound which had awakened him, although it could have done, since he was not upstairs in his bed, but down below, in the shop itself. The Emporium Galorium was a cave of darkness, crowded with hulking shadows created by the street lamp outside, which managed to send just enough light through the dirty plate-glass windows to create the unpleasant feeling of things hiding beyond the borders of vision. It wasn't the clocks that woke him. It was the flash. He was horrified to find himself standing in his pajamas beside his work table with the Polaroid Sun 660 in his hands. The special drawer was open. He was aware that, although he had taken only a single picture, his finger had been pushing the button which triggered the shutter again and again and again. He would have taken a great many more than the one that protruded from the slot at the bottom of the camera, but for the simple good luck, there had been only a single picture left in the film pack currently in the camera. Pop started to lower his arms. He had been holding the camera pointed toward the front of the shop. The viewfinder, with its minute hairline crack, held up to one open, sleeping eye. and when he got them down as far as his ribcage, they began to tremble, and the muscles holding the hinges of his elbows just seemed to give way. His arms fell, his fingers opened, and the camera tumbled back into the special drawer with a clatter. The picture he had taken slipped from the slot and fluttered. It struck one edge of the open drawer, teetered first one way as if it would follow the camera in, and then the other. It fell on the floor.
Heart attack, Pop thought incoherently. I'm going to have a goddamn Christin heart attack.
He tried to raise his right arm, wanting to massage the left side of his chest with the hand on the end of it, but the arm wouldn't come. The hand on the end of it dangled, as limp as a dead man at the end of a hang rope. The world wavered in and out of focus. The sound of the clocks, the tardy ones were just finishing up, faded away to distant echoes. The pain in his chest diminished. The light seemed to come back a little, and he realized all he was doing was trying to faint. He made to sit down in the wheeled chair behind the work table, and the business of lowering himself into the seat, like the business of lowering the camera, began all right, but before he had gotten even halfway down, those hinges, the ones that strapped his thighs and calves together by way of his knees, also gave way, and he didn't so much sit in the chair as cave into it. It rolled a foot backward, struck a crate filled with old Life and Look magazines, and stopped. Pop put his head down, the way you were supposed to do when you felt lightheaded, and time passed. He had no idea at all, then or later, how much. He might even have gone back to sleep for a little while, but when he raised his head, he was more or less all right again. There was a steady, dull throbbing at his temples and behind his forehead, probably because he had stuffed his goddamn noodle with blood, hanging it over so long that way. But he found he could stand up, and he knew what he had to do. When the thing had gotten hold of him so badly it could make him walk in his sleep, then make him, his mind tried to revolt at that verb, that make, but he wouldn't let it. Take pictures with it. That was enough. He had no idea what the goddamn thing was. But one thing was clear. You couldn't compromise with it.
Time to do what you should have let the boy do in the first place.
Yes, but not tonight. He was exhausted, drenched with sweat and shivering. He thought he would have his work cut out for him just climbing the stairs to his apartment again, let alone swinging that sledge. He supposed he could do the job in here, simply pick it out of the drawer and dash it against the floor again and again, but there was a deeper truth, and he'd better own up to it. He couldn't have any more truck with that camera tonight. The morning would be time enough, and the camera couldn't do any damage between now and then, could it? There was no film in it. Pop shut the drawer and locked it. Then he got up slowly, looking more like a man pushing 80 than 70, and tottered slowly to the stairs. He climbed them one at a time, resting on each, clinging to the banister, which was none too solid itself, with one hand, while he held his heavy bunch of keys on their steel ring in the other. At last he made the top. With the door shut behind him, he seemed to feel a little stronger. He went back into his bedroom and got into bed, unaware, as always, of the strong yellow smell of sweat and old man that puffed up when he lay down. He changed the sheets on the first of every month and called it good.
I won't sleep now, he thought, and then, yes, you will. You will because you can. And you can because tomorrow morning you're going to take the sledge and pound that fucking thing to pieces and there's an end to it.
This thought and sleep came simultaneously, and Pop slept without dreaming, almost without moving, all the rest of that night. When he woke, he was astonished to hear the clocks downstairs seeming to chime an extra stroke, all of them, 8 instead of 7. It wasn't until he looked at the light falling across the floor and wall in a slightly slanted oblong that he realized it really was 8. He had overslept for the first time in 10 years. Then he remembered the night before. Now, in daylight, the whole episode seemed less weird. Had he nearly fainted? Or was that maybe just a natural sort of weakness that came to a sleepwalker when he was unexpectedly wakened? But of course, that was it, wasn't it? A little bright morning sunshine wasn't going to change that central fact. He had walked in his sleep. He had taken at least one picture, and would have taken a whole slew of them if there had been more film in the pack. He got up, got dressed, and went downstairs, meaning to see the thing in pieces before he even had his morning's coffee. Kevin wished his first visit to the two-dimensional town of Polaroidsville had also been his last visit there, but that was not the case. During the 13 nights since the first one, he'd had the dream more and more often. If the dumb dream happened to take the night off, little vacation, Kev, but see you soon, okay? He was apt to have it twice the next night. Now he always knew it was a dream, and as soon as it started, he would tell himself that all he had to do was wake himself up. Damn it, just wake yourself up. Sometimes he did wake up, and sometimes the dream just faded back into deeper sleep, but he never succeeded in waking himself up. It was always Polaroidsville now, never Oatley or Hildesville, those first two efforts of his fumbling mind to identify the place. And like the photograph, each dream took the action just a little bit further. First, the man with the shopping cart, which was never empty now even to start with, but filled with a jumble of objects, mostly clocks, but all from the Emporium Galorium, and all with the eerie look, not of real things, but rather photographs of real things, which had been cut out of magazines and then somehow, impossibly, paradoxically, stuffed into a shopping cart, which, since it was two-dimensional as the objects themselves, had no breadth in which to store them. Yet there they were, and the old man hunched protectively over them and told Kevin to get out, that he was a flushing thief. Only now, he also told Kevin that if he didn't get out,
I'll sick Pop's dog on you, see if I don't.
The fat woman, who couldn't be fat since she was perfectly flat, but who was fat anyway, came next. She appeared pushing her own shopping cart, filled with Polaroid Sun cameras. She also spoke to him before he passed her.
Be careful, boy, she'd say in the loud but toneless voice of one who is utterly deaf. Pop's dog broke his leash, and he's a mean un. He tore up three or four people at the Trenton Farm in Camberville before he came here. It's hard to take his picture, but you can't do it at all unless you have a camera.
She would bend to get one, would sometimes get as far as holding it out. He would reach for the camera, not knowing why the woman would think he should take the dog's picture, or why he'd want to, or maybe he was just trying to be polite. Either way, it made no difference. They both moved with the stately slowness of underwater swimmers, as dream people so often do, and they always just missed making connections. When Kevin thought of this part of the dream, he always thought of the famous picture of God and Adam which Michelangelo had painted on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, each of them with an arm outstretched, and each with the hand at the end of the arm also outstretched, and the forefingers almost, not quite, but almost touching. Then she would disappear for a moment, because she had no width, and when she reappeared again, she was out of reach. Well, just go back to her then, Kevin would think each time the dream reached this point. But he couldn't. His feet carried him heedlessly and serenely onward to the peeling white picket fence and Pop and the dog. Only the dog was no longer a dog, but some horrible mixed thing that gave off heat and smoke like a dragon and had the teeth and twisted, scarred snout of a wild pig. Pop and the sun dog would turn toward him at the same time, and Pop would have the camera. His camera, Kevin knew, because there was a piece chipped out of the side, up to his right eye. His left eye was squinted shut. His rimless spectacles glinted on top of his head in hazy sunlight. Pop and the sun dog had all three dimensions. They were the only things in this seedy, creepy little dream town that did.
He's the one, Pop cried in a shrill, fearful voice. He's the thief. Sick him, boy. Pull his fucking guts out is what I mean to say.
And as he screamed out this last, heatless lightning flashed in the day as Pop triggered the shutter and the flash, and Kevin turned to run. The dream had stopped here the second time he had had it. Now, on each subsequent occasion, things went a little further. Again, he was moving with the aquatic slowness of a performer in an underwater ballet. He felt that if he had been outside himself, He would even have looked like a dancer, his arms turning like the blades of a propeller just starting up, his shirt twisting with his body, pulling taut across his chest and his belly at the same time he heard the shirt's tail pulling free of his pants at the small of his back with a magnified rasp like sandpaper. Then he was running back the way he came, each foot rising slowly, and then floating, dreamily. Of course dreamily, what else, you fool, he would think at this point every time. Back down until it hit the cracked and listless cement of the sidewalk, the soles of his tennis shoes flattening as they took his weight and spanking up small clouds of grit, moving so slowly that he could see the individual particles revolving like atoms. He ran slowly. Yes, of course. And the sundog, nameless stray grendel of a thing that came from nowhere and signified nothing, and had all the sense of a cyclone, but existed nevertheless, chased him slowly, but not quite as slowly. On the third night, the dream faded into normal sleep, just as Kevin began to turn his head in that dragging, maddening, slow motion to see how much of a lead he had on the dog. It then skipped a night. On the following night, it returned. Twice. In the first dream, he got his head halfway around, so he could see the street on his left disappearing into limbo behind him as he ran along it. In the second, and from this one his alarm clock woke him, sweating lightly in a crouched, fetal position on the far side of the bed. He got his head turned enough to see the dog just as its forepaws came down in his own tracks. And he saw the paws were digging crumbly little craters in the cement because they had sprouted claws. And from the back of each lower leg joint there protruded a long thorn of a bone that looked like a spur. The thing's muddy, reddish eye was locked on Kevin. Dim fire blew and dripped from its nostrils. Jesus! Jesus Christ! Its snot's on fire! Kevin thought, and when he awoke he was horrified to hear himself whispering it over and over, very rapidly. Snot's on fire! Snot's on fire! Snot's on fire! Night by night, the dog gained on him as he fled down the sidewalk. Even when he wasn't turning to look, he could hear the sundog gaining. He was aware of a spread of warmth from his crotch, and he knew he was in enough fear to have wet himself, although the emotion came through in the same diluted, numbed way he seemed to have to move in this world. He could hear the sundog's paws striking the cement, could hear the dry crack and squall of the cement breaking. He could hear the hot blurts of its breath, the suck of air flowing in past those outrageous teeth. And on the night Pop woke up to find he had not only walked in his sleep, but taken at least one picture of it, Kevin felt as well as heard the sundog's breath for the first time. A warm rush of air on his buttocks, like the sultry suck of wind a subway on an express run pulls through a station where it needn't stop. He knew the dog was close enough to spring on his back now, and that would come next. He would feel one more breath. This one, not just warm but hot as acute indigestion in your throat. And then that crooked, living bear trap of a mouth would sink deep into the flesh of his back, between the shoulder blades, ripping the skin and meat off his spine. And did he think this was really just a dream? Did he? He awoke from this last one just as Pop was gaining the top of the stairs to his apartment and resting one final time before going inside back to bed. This time Kevin woke sitting bolt upright, the sheet and blanket which had been over him puddled around his waist, his skin covered with sweat, and yet freezing, a million little white goose pimples standing out all over his belly, chest, back, and arms like stigmata. Even his cheeks seemed to crawl with them. And what he thought about was not the dream, or at least not directly. He thought instead, it's wrong. The number is wrong. It says 3, but it can't. Then he flopped back. And in the way of children, for even at 15 most of him was still a child, and would be until later that day, he fell into a deep sleep again. The alarm woke him at 7:30, as it always did on school mornings, and he found himself sitting up in bed again, wide-eyed, every piece suddenly in place. The sun he had smashed hadn't been his sun, and that was why he kept having this same crazy dream over and over again. Pop Merrill, that kindly old Cracker Barrel philosopher and repairer of cameras and clocks and small appliances, had euchred him and his father as neatly and competently as a riverboat gambler does the tenderfeet in an old Western movie. His father! He heard the door downstairs slam shut and leaped out of bed. He took two running strides toward the door in his underwear, thought better of it, turned, yanked the window up and hollered, "Dad!" just as his father was folding himself into the car to go to work. Pop dredged his keyring up from his pocket, unlocked the special drawer, and took out the camera, once again being careful to hold it by the strap only. He looked with some hope at the front of the Polaroid, thinking he might see that the lens had been smashed in its latest tumble, hoping that the goddamn thing's eye had been poked out, you might say. But his father had been fond of saying that the devil's luck is always in, and that seemed to be the case with Kevin Delavan's goddamn camera. The chipped place on the thing's side had chipped away a little more, but that was all. He closed the drawer, and as he turned the key, saw the one picture he'd taken in his sleep, lying face down on the floor. As unable not to look at it as Lot's wife had been unable not to turn her back and look at the destruction of Sodom, he picked it up with those blunt fingers that hid their dexterity from the world so well, and turned it over. The dog creature had begun its spring. Its forepaws had barely left the ground, but along its misshapen backbone, and in the bunches of muscle under the hide, with its hair like the stiff filaments sticking out of black steel brushes, he could see all that kinetic energy beginning to release itself. Its face and head were actually a little blurred in this photograph, as its mouth yawned wider and drifting up from the picture, like a sound heard under glass. He seemed to hear a low and throaty snarl beginning to rise toward a roar. The shadow photographer looked as if he were trying to stumble back another pace, but what did it matter? That was smoke jetting from the holes in the dog thing's muzzle, all right. Smoke, and more smoke drifting back from the hinges of its open jaws in the little space where the croggled and ugly steak wall of its teeth ended. And any man would stumble back from a horror like that. Any man would try to turn and run. But all Pop had to do was look to tell you that the man, of course it was a man. Maybe once it had been a boy, a teenage boy, but who had the camera now? Who had taken that picture in mere startled reflex, with a kind of wince of the finger? That man didn't have a nickel's worth of chances. That man could keep his beat or trip over them, and all the difference it would make would be as to how he died, while he was on his feet or while he was on his ass. Pop crumpled the picture between his fingers, then stuck his key ring back in his pocket. He turned, holding what had been Kevin Delavan's Polaroid Sun 660, and was now his Polaroid Sun 660, by the strap, and started toward the back of the store. He would pause on the way, just long enough to get the sledge, and as he neared the door to the back shed, a shutter flash, huge and white and soundless, went off not in front of his eyes, but behind them, in his brain. He turned back, and now his eyes were as empty as the eyes of a man who has been temporarily blinded by some bright light. He walked past the work table with the camera now held in his hands at chest level, as one might carry a votive urn or some other sort of religious offering or relic. Halfway between the work table and the front of the store was a bureau covered with clocks. To its left was one of the barn-like structure's support beams, and from a hook planted in this there hung another clock, an imitation German cuckoo clock. Pop grasped it by the roof and pulled it off its hook, indifferent to the counterweights, which immediately became entangled in one another's chains, and to the pendulum, which snapped off when one of the disturbed chains tried to twine around it. The little door below the roof peak of the clock sprang ajar. The wooden bird poked out its beak and one startled eye. It gave a single choked sound, "Kook!" as if in protest of this rough treatment before creeping back inside again. Pop hung the Sun by its strap on the hook where the clock had been, then turned and moved toward the back of the store for the second time, his eyes still blank and dazzled. He clutched the clock by its roof, swinging it back and forth indifferently, not hearing the cluds and clunks from inside it, or the occasional strangled sound that might have been the bird trying to escape. Not noticing when one of the counterweights smacked the end of an old bed, snapped off, and went rolling beneath, leaving a deep trail in the undisturbed dust of years. He moved with the blank, mindless purpose of a robot. In the shed, he paused just long enough to pick up the sledgehammer by its smooth shaft. With both hands thus filled, he had to use the elbow of his left arm to knock the hook out of the eye bolt so he could push open the shed door and walk into the backyard. He crossed to the chopping block and set the imitation German cuckoo clock on it. He stood for a moment with his head inclined down toward it, both of his hands now on the handle of the sledge. His face remained blank, his eyes dim and dazzled. But there was a part of his mind which not only thought clearly, but thought all of him was thinking and acting clearly. This part of his mind really believed he had come downstairs, gotten the Polaroid from the drawer, and proceeded directly out back, pausing only to get the sledge. And it was this part that would do his remembering later, unless it became convenient for him to remember some other truth, or any other truth for that matter. Pop Merrill raised the sledgehammer over his right shoulder and brought it down hard. Not as hard as Kevin had done, but hard enough to do the job. It struck squarely on the roof of the imitation German cuckoo clock. The clock did not so much break or shatter as splatter. Pieces of plastic wood and little gears and springs flew everywhere. And what that little piece of Pop which saw would remember, unless of course it became convenient to remember otherwise, were pieces of camera splattering everywhere. He pulled the sledge off the block and stood for a moment with his meditating, unseeing eyes on the shambles. The bird, which to Pop looked exactly like a film case, a Polaroid Sun film case, was lying on its back with its little wooden feet sticking straight up in the air, looking both deader than any bird outside of a cartoon ever looked, and yet, somehow, miraculously unhurt at the same time. He had his look, then turned and headed toward the shed door.
"There," he muttered under his breath. "Good enough."
Someone standing, even very close to him, might have been unable to pick up the words themselves, but it would have been hard to miss the unmistakable tone of relief with which they were spoken.
"That's done. Don't have to worry about that anymore. Now what's next? Pipe tobacco, isn't it?"
But when he got to the drugstore on the other side of the block 15 minutes later, it was not pipe tobacco he asked for, although that was what he would remember asking for. He asked for film. Polaroid film. "Kevin, I'm going to be late for work if I don't... Will you call in? Can you? Call in and say you'll be late, or you might not get there at all. If it was something really, really, really important..." Warily, Mr. Delavan asked, "What's the something?
Could you?"
Mrs. Delavan was standing in the doorway of Kevin's bedroom now. Meg was behind her. Both of them were eyeing the man in his business suit and the tall boy still wearing only his jockey shorts curiously. "I suppose I... yes, say I could, but I won't until I know what it is." Kevin lowered his voice, and cutting his eyes toward the door, he said,
"It's about Pop Merrill and the camera."
Mr. Delavan, who had at first only looked puzzled at what Kevin's eyes were doing, now went to the door. He murmured something to his wife, who nodded. Then he closed the door, paying no more attention to Meg's protesting whine than he would have to a bird singing a bundle of notes on a telephone wire outside the bedroom window.
"What did you tell Mom?"
Kevin asked.
"That it was man-to-man stuff," Mr. Delavan smiled a little. "I think she thinks you want to talk about masturbating."
Kevin flushed. Mr. Delavan looked concerned.
"You don't, do you? I mean, you know about..."
I know,
Kevin said hastily. He was not about to tell his father, and wasn't sure he would have been able to put the right string of words together even if he had wanted to, that what had thrown him momentarily off track was finding out that not only did his father know about whacking off, which of course shouldn't have surprised him at all, but somehow did, leaving him with feelings of surprise at his own surprise, but that his mother somehow did too. Never mind,
All this had nothing to do with the nightmares or with the new certainty which had locked into place in his head. It's about Pop, I told you, and some bad dreams I've been having, but mostly it's about the camera because Pop stole it somehow, Dad.
Kevin,
I beat it to pieces on his chopping block, I know, but it wasn't my camera, it was another camera. And that isn't even the worst thing. The worst thing is that he's still using mine to take pictures, and that dog is going to get out. When it does, I think it's going to kill me. In that other world, it's already started to...
He couldn't finish. Kevin surprised himself again, this time by bursting into tears. By the time John Delavan got his son calmed down, it was 8:10, and he had resigned himself to at least being late for work. He held the boy in his arms. Whatever it was, it really had the kid shook. And if it really was nothing but a bunch of dreams, Mr. Delavan supposed he would find sex at the root of the matter someplace. When Kevin was shivering and only sucking breath into his lungs in an occasional dry sob, Mr. Delavan went to the door and opened it cautiously, hoping Kate had taken Meg downstairs. She had. The hallway was empty. That's one for our side anyway, he thought, and went back to Kevin.
Can you talk now? He asked.
Pop's got my camera, Kevin said hoarsely.
His red eyes, still watery, peered at his father almost myopically.
He got it somehow, and he's using it.
And this is something you dreamed?
Yes, and I remembered something.
Kevin, that was your camera. I'm sorry, son, but it was. I even saw the little chip in the side.
He must have rigged that somehow.
Kevin, that seems pretty far-fetched.
Listen, Kevin said urgently. Would you just listen?
All right, yes, I'm listening.
What I remembered was that when he handed me the camera, when we went out back to crunch it, remember?
Yes.
I looked in the little window where the camera keeps count of how many shots there are left, and it said 3, Dad. It said 3.
Well, what about it?
It had film in it, too. Film. I know, because I remember one of those shiny black things jumped up when I squashed the camera. It jumped up and then it fluttered back down.
I repeat, so what?
There wasn't any film in my camera when I gave it to Pop. That's so what. I had 28 pictures. He wanted me to take 30 more, for a total of 58. I might have bought more film if I'd known what he was up to, but probably not. By then I was scared of the thing.
Yeah, I was a little, too.
Kevin looked at him respectfully.
Were you?
Yeah. Go on. I think I see where you're heading. I was just going to say, he chipped in for the film, but not enough. Not even half. He's a wicked skinflint, Dad.
John Delavan smiled thinly. He is that, my boy. One of the world's greatest, is what I mean to say.
Go on and finish up. Tempest is fugiting away like mad.
Kevin glanced at the clock. It was almost 8, although neither of them knew it. Pop would wake up in just under 2 minutes and start about his morning's business, very little of which he would remember correctly.
All right, Kevin said. All I'm trying to say is, I couldn't have bought any more film, even if I wanted to. I used all the money I had buying the 3 film packs. I even borrowed a buck from Megan, so I let her shoot a couple, too.
Between the two of you, you used up all the exposures, every single one?
Yes, yes. He even said it was 58. And between the time when I finished shooting all the pictures he wanted and when we went to look at the tape he made, I never bought any more film. It was dead empty when I brought it in, Dad. The number in the little window was a 0. I saw it. I remember. So if it was my camera, how come it said 3 in the window when we went back downstairs?
He couldn't have...
Then his father stopped, and a queer look of uncharacteristic gloom came over his face as he realized that Pop could have, and that the truth of it was this. He, John Delavan, didn't want to believe that Pop had, that even bitter experience had not been sufficient vaccination against foolishness, and Pop might have pulled the wool over his own eyes as well as those of his son.
Couldn't have what? What are you thinking about, Dad? Something just hit you.
Something had hit him, all right. How eager Pop had been to go downstairs and get the original Polaroids so they could all get a closer look at the thing around the dog's neck, the thing that had turned out to be Kevin's latest string tie from Aunt Hilda, the one with the bird on it that was probably a woodpecker.
"We might as well go down with you,"
Kevin had said when Pop had offered to get the photos. But hadn't Pop jumped up himself, chipper as a chickadee?
"Won't take a minute,"
the old man had said, or some such thing. And the truth was, Mr. Delavan told himself, I hardly noticed what he was saying or doing, because I wanted to watch that goddamn tape again. And the truth also was this. Pop hadn't even had to pull the old switcheroo right in front of them, although with his eyes unwooled, Mr. Delavan was reluctantly willing to believe the old son of a bitch had probably been prepared to do just that if he had to, and probably could have done it, too, pushing 70 or not. With them upstairs and him downstairs, presumably doing no more than getting Kevin's photographs, he could have swapped 20 cameras at his leisure.
"Dad?"
"I suppose he could have," Mr. Delavan said.
"But why?"
Kevin could only shake his head. He didn't know why. But that was all right. Mr. Delavan thought he did, and it was something of a relief. Maybe honest men didn't have to learn the world's simplest truths over and over again. Maybe some of those truths eventually stuck fast. He'd only had to articulate the question aloud in order to find the answer. Why did the Pop Merrills of this world do anything? To make a profit. That was the reason, the whole reason, and nothing but the reason. Kevin had wanted to destroy it. After looking at Pop's videotape, Mr. Delavan had found himself in accord with that. Of the three of them, who had been the only one capable of taking a longer view? Why, Pop, of course. Reginald Marion Pop Merrill.